we need food for this family, okay? Because we are not well. We are not fine here. Everybody here is suffering.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's been more than a week since the earthquake hit Haiti, and the city of Port-au-Prince and its people remain in dire straits. Meanwhile, aid workers scramble to bring relief in the face of mounting criticism.
Why isn't the aid getting through? They collectively scream, and I would like to invite them to Port-au-Prince on a good day and see how long it takes them to cross the street, much less deliver hundreds of thousands of tons of food and water to 3 million people through stench and wreckage and shooting and burning and blockades built of the dead.
This week, voices from the streets of Port-au-Prince. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Last week on the show, we interviewed reporter Amelia De Sosa, who lives in Port-au-Prince. She was in the UN building when it collapsed, killing many of the workers inside. Amelia managed to get out, and now she's living in the UN compound next to the Port-au-Prince airport. She sent us this letter from the compound, where people are scrambling to distribute aid.
Dear practically everyone, let me give you a sense of these last days. It's occurred to me that there is a word for what I am. Refugee. It fits. My entire office of more than 30 people is squeezed into a small building in our compound by the airport, comprising just 3 rooms. We sleep on camp cots or on the ground outside the building because no one is quite comfortable in a closed space yet. There is a bit of grass and a concrete pathway. We listen to the drone of military planes landing and leaving the airport all night. I can see the lights of the massive planes fly just over my face when I lie on my cot, and it is the only time I really stop to think about anything that has happened. Sometimes I cry. Then I fall into a dreamless slumber, swathed in mosquito repellent, in my clothes, until 7 a.m., and wake up with the sun high. We stumble into our office with rumpled hair, smile sheepishly at each other, and smooth out our clothes. If we have other ones, we might change them. But if we don't, who cares anyway? There's too much to do. Yesterday, I was wearing my boss's shirt. No one even noticed. We're lucky to have a bathroom in our office and a shower, so I do wash. But I don't think I brushed my hair today, or at least I can't remember anyway. Then for me, it's a frantic dash to get from thing to thing. Bill Clinton visits, a food distribution goes awry, Ban Ki-moon lays a wreath at the site of our offices, and a survivor somewhere is pulled from the rubble, alive, by God, alive. News, 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 it never stops. It is an insatiable animal, and I am the newskeeper. I have to keep feeding the machine. So our 2 camera crews go out. They fight their way through blocked, smoking, stench-filled wreckage to grab images that you see every day, then charge back to the office, to me, to hand me the tapes, and slam bam, thank you ma'am, I cut it and throw it out to the world, to you. Meanwhile, from time to time, a colleague sits in a side room with a staff counselor, receiving some very bad news. You know this happens when they come out red-eyed and broken, but somehow relieved. The news has arrived. The body was found, and now the knowledge sits like a boulder on every movement and thought this person will ever have. But at least they know. And there is relief in it to have a place to bury the body, to have a confirmed reason to grieve, and then more often than not, they go back to their desk, wipe clear their eyes, and get back to work. One of my colleagues told me last night about his girlfriend who is lost in the big rubble graveyard that was my office. I don't hope for her. I know she is dead. He says it and looks at the sky where the planes are passing. He shrugs. What can I do? Maybe she will come now and visit me in my dreams. I love her. And I don't know how I will go home and clean up her things. And he comes to work every day and he smiles and tells jokes. And then sits apart and cries sometimes. stares, sighs, gets up, and then he wipes his eyes and goes back to work. I guess this is why I don't think about anything until very late at night, watching the taillights of the aircraft bringing help and hurt across the sky. My other good friend here has signed up for probably the worst job there is. Her office no longer functions because there are no longer uses for things like language training or career development. Now, those concepts seem absurd. So she volunteered for duty at the morgue, and her job is to take photos of the dead. She's young and beautiful, from Paris. She loves to read Vogue and wear pretty red high-heeled shoes. But she spends her days now photographing the decomposed remains of the people we worked with, the ones that annoyed us, the ones we loved. And it has to be done. There has to be the proof that they are gone. And for some, it's impossible to tell who it is. They must search the pocket for an ID card or look for a signet ring. She sat in my office today, impassive, exhausted. She looked down at her sneakers and said, "I think I will throw these away." One last thing. I work in the news business, so I see the things that the agencies say about us, CNN, the major networks. They decry the slowness and the disorganization and defame the UN, the Red Cross, the American soldiers. Why isn't the aid getting through? They collectively scream, and I would like to invite them to Port-au-Prince on a good day and see how long it takes them to cross the street, much less deliver hundreds of thousands of tons of food and water to 3 million people through stench and wreckage and shooting and burning and blockades built of the dead. And I look around my office at my colleagues who have lost their husbands and their secretaries, their hard drives and their homes, who sleep on cots by the airport and slam their way through the day so fast, probably so they don't have to spend too much time thinking. And I think, hey man, cut us some slack, because we're doing our damnedest. And the truth is, we are victims too. But I'm going to end this message on a good note. Today's my mother's birthday, and we talked about how we have so much to be thankful for. Our families, our friends. Heck, I even have clean underwear. So with that, I leave you, thankful to be alive and looking forward to another night, tracing planes across the sky. I am sure you will see pieces of me tomorrow, behind the scenes, as you watch the news. I send you my love from Haiti. Please send us your prayers. Love, Amelia.
That was Amelia De Sosa from the UN compound in Port-au-Prince. She'll be sending us regular letters from Haiti. You can see photos of the relief effort on our website, worldvisionreport.org. More than a week after the massive earthquake, Haitians are still desperate for food, water, and medical help. Journalist Amy Bracken is there to cover the crisis. Amy, thanks so much for joining us from Port-au-Prince.
Thank you.
Amy, you've been reporting all week in Haiti, and the World Food Program is reporting that it may be as much as a month before food gets to everyone who needs it. So it sounds like a lot more people may die just because they can't hold out long enough. What's going to happen?
There are a lot of individual organizations that are sort of cropping up that are helping people in need. I talked to a woman at a nearby restaurant, one of the few restaurants that's open in Pétionville. And this woman, it's a couple at a small restaurant. They've been serving about 450 people every day at one nearby park, which has become a tent camp. They're looking for aid. They're hoping to get some help from the French embassy and the Dominican embassy. But they've just been doing it all out of their own pocket and their own stashes. And then the U.S. military has kicked in. The U.S. Army has taken over a golf course, and which has now become a refugee camp of up to 50,000 people at night. And they've been serving what seems like a lot of people. I mean, thousands of people, but it's not nearly covering the need. There's a little bit of commerce going on in these refugee camps, and people are sharing, but people are still desperately hungry and thirsty. And there are signs all over the place saying, "Please help us. We need food, water, and medicine." this gentleman I met, Hilaire Jean-Francois, was sleeping on the street with his wife and young child, selling spaghetti. He still had a cauldron and charcoal to cook the spaghetti, but this was breakfast time and not a lot of people were buying.
How about medical care? Is there any good news on that front?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the General Hospital, another of the hospitals downtown that's standing, it's been getting better and better. More and more doctors and supplies have been coming in. I stumbled across a clinic outside. There was a street that was closed in Pétionville today, and there was a plastic surgery clinic that happened to be there, and they've joined up with two French NGOs, and they're doing plastic surgery on a lot of people who have had severe damage to their faces and other parts of their bodies, and they also have a number of orthopedic surgeons who are working on various bone injuries, and they're trying to get an x-ray machine in so that they can even work on spinal injuries.
Amy, what are you seeing that we're not hearing about here in the media? Anything we should know about?
What's coming back to me, I mean, I'm not seeing a whole lot of the outside media, but people keep asking me about the security situation. I know that there is cause for a lot of concern. However, I've been blown away by how gracious people are with each other, and particularly at these camps. I mean, this enormous camp on this golf course that I went to, there were people who were forming cleanup committees. And there was one artist who had this very funky little setup of a cardboard structure that he was calling the National Palace and inviting people in to visit and hang out with him.
Amy, I know you've spoken to a lot of people in these camps, and I understand you have a couple clips to play for us.
Yeah, well, one is Jonas Pierre, who I met this morning when I was walking around, and he's a furniture maker. He makes tables, and he was there with about 10 family members, including his 5 children, and they were really in these horrific conditions, sleeping on sheets on the concrete.
We need food for this family. Okay, because we are not well, we are not fine here. So you can help me in my situation, okay? But because the people is suffering, okay? But I don't know if you will help me, but everybody here is suffering, okay?
Amy, we've heard about kind of spontaneous worship services in these camps, people singing and praying at night. Have you seen this?
I was surprised that when we were walking around, we stumbled across these very well-dressed young men who are regulars at church, and they sing and play guitar. And they were singing a song called Persevere, about having faith in God, and that's how they survive.
All right, Amy Bracken, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be staying in touch with you.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Bracken, a freelance reporter in Port-au-Prince. Just ahead, survivors of earthquakes in other countries pitch in to help Haiti. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Mexico's response to the Haiti disaster has been swift and energetic, especially in the capital, which had its own devastating quake 25 years ago. Grant Fuller reports from Mexico City.
City officials moved quickly last week to set up this donation center right in the middle of the main plaza downtown. And if the mood here is any indication, Mexico City is very happy to help Haiti. Two dozen bus drivers and policemen chant, "We can do it," as they form a human chain. They're loading a truck with heavy packs of water destined for a ship to Haiti. 72-year-old Scenario Lopez also came to pitch in. Wearing a straw cowboy hat and wool sweater, he takes a break from lifting water and explains why he traveled 2 hours to get here.
I'm here of my own will because we've also experienced an earthquake. And it's only fair to help our Haitian brothers and sisters. Today's for them, tomorrow could be for us.
Back in 1985, Mexico City was devastated by a magnitude 8.1 earthquake that killed more than 10,000 people. and it left a deep impression on those who lived through it. Now, it's their turn to help. Elias Moreno, the city's civil protection secretary, stands among stacks of water as he watches the chanting volunteers in action.
Aquí estás oyendo la solidaridad de la gente y las ganas de ayudar.
Right here, you're hearing the people's solidarity and desire to help, because all this makes them remember what they lived through at that time. Even for those who weren't alive in 85, that story has been passed on from generation to generation. That historical memory is what makes us understand better than most people what's happening right now in Haiti.
It's a destroyed city, completely destroyed. That's what stuck out in my mind. A city that's seriously, seriously damaged.
Carlos Hernandez is part of Mexico City's rescue squad. He and his team are just back from working 4 days straight in Port-au-Prince. Mexican search and rescue workers have had a hand in pulling 17 people from the rubble alive. Hernandez has been doing this job for 23 years, but he says the conditions in Haiti were the toughest he's ever seen.
Ningún país está capacitado y entrenado y tiene los recursos para un evento.
No country has the ability, training, and resources for an event of this magnitude. I mean, this just crushed my idea of how bad a disaster could be. And no city is prepared, I believe, for something so big.
In addition to contributing the rescue teams, Mexico City sent more than 200 tons of emergency aid in the first week. At the Haitian embassy, a few doctors and pharmacists guide volunteers in sorting out donated medicine. This one's for the stomach, that one's for pain. Volunteer Maria de Los Angeles has been here for hours. She was 35 years old when the Mexico City earthquake struck, and she helped run a shelter for those left homeless.
I think tragedies bring us together like family, and this time it's forcing the world to turn towards Haiti, which is such a poor country. Before, we didn't pay any attention to them, but now we've all opened our eyes to see them.
In the embassy's backyard, hallway, garage, even outside on the street, hundreds of volunteers do what they can to speed up delivery of food, water, and medicine to Haiti. At a makeshift sign-in table, Jean Giropeo watches with amazement. He's a 27-year-old Haitian student, and he still doesn't know the fate of his parents who live near Port-au-Prince. The other day, he saw a 3-year-old boy who came here with his mother. The child struggled to unload a can of beans from their car.
His mom went over to him and said, "No, honey, you're not big enough yet." And the child told her, "No, mommy, I can do it because it's for my brothers and sisters in Haiti." So those words help to give you strength and hope. And you see that even from their homes, the whole world is supporting you in their hearts.
The Haitian tragedy has made Mexicans stop and think about their own vulnerability to such a disaster. But Elias Moreno, the civil protection secretary, claims they'll be ready if a major quake strikes here again.
Yo creo que cada vez estamos mejor preparados. Y esto siempre es un aprendizaje.
I think we're getting more prepared all the time. And it's always a learning process. The building codes are very strict now, and we're even among the few countries of the world that have an earthquake alert system. It's not perfect, and we still lack some things, but we're on the right track.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Mexico City.
Hi, I'm Ishma Fundiqua, Global Music Guide for the World Vision Report. We've heard so much of the misery, mayhem, and despair that followed the earthquake in Haiti, but we are now going to take a break from that for just a moment and focus on one of Haiti's cultural riches, its music. One of Haiti's leading bands is Bookman Experience. It is named after Dudy Bookman, a voodoo priest who led a slave revolt in the 18th century. He was executed by the Spanish. The band, meanwhile, pioneered a blend of Afro-Haitian music where they used traditional instruments and also feature rock guitar, funk, and reggae bass lines. While their music is mostly upbeat, they have quieter moments. Noel Innocent, or Innocent Christmas, a song of both anguish and hope, is a good example of that. Another Haitian band that has made a mark internationally is Boucan Guinée. Boucan is Creole for bonfire or fire pit. Guinea is said to refer to Guinea, West Africa, from where a lot of Africans were shipped to the island as slaves. Here is Bukan Guinea and the beautiful Jua River. Jua River means the day will come. On the track, the band longs for the day when all people can be united and poverty and sadness will be banished. In this very difficult time for the people of Haiti, we wish them all that and more. I'm Ishma Fundikwa, Global Music Guide for the World Vision Report.
We'll hear more from Ish a little later in the show. Laura Blank is with World Vision, an aid organization with 400 aid workers on the ground in Haiti. We spoke with her from Port-au-Prince. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Laura, what is the greatest challenge these days for aid groups like World Vision?
Well, one of the things that we're finding is that the camps where people have set up temporary shelter are scattered all over the city, and they're not in places that are easily accessible. You may imagine a camp like these to be kind of in a flat, open soccer field or a parking lot, but people are up on hillsides in small groups at a time, kind of down deep ravines. So when we're talking about doing mass distributions with a truck and bringing in supplies, registering people, getting them in lines, it can be difficult to figure out how to do that when the only way you can get up the mountaintop is on foot. So I think that's been one of the biggest challenges that our staff are trying to figure out right now.
We see many images on TV of looting and chaos and people desperate for supplies. How is it where World Vision is working? Is it orderly or is there this chaos that we're seeing?
Things seem to be fairly stable right now. There is certainly a sense of tension. I think people are anxious. They want to know where their next meal is coming from. How are they going to provide for their children? Seen any widespread chaos or violence at this point, but there is concern that that could change.
And what's happening, Laura, outside of Port-au-Prince? We hear about whole towns being destroyed, like Jacmel. Any World Vision aid groups focusing there?
We actually just sent a team out to do an assessment to one of the smaller towns that's just west of Port-au-Prince, and we're also thinking about if we have the capacity to go to Jacmel as well. There's a local NGO here known as ACDI VOCA that's been working there, but I know many other NGOs, including World Vision, are trying to figure out how we can reach out beyond the city, because what we've heard is that up to 90% of some of these cities have been destroyed. We're also doing some work on the border of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, where people have just been naturally going to try to seek help there.
We know that many children are suffering and are still separated from their families. What are aid groups, and your group in particular, doing for children?
Well, one of the things that World Vision does traditionally in these kind of disaster, and we're hoping to start doing here too, is something called child-friendly spaces. These are, it can be a tent, it can be outdoors, it can be in a building, depending on the environment. Most likely we'll use tents here because we have them easily accessible and children can feel safe there. They don't have to worry about being inside a building if there was another aftershock or an earthquake. And it's a place for children just to play. They often sing songs, they make color, do projects, but also underlying there's an intent to help the children process through what they've experienced as a result of the disaster, or in this case, the earthquake. But in a practical sense, it also gives parents a place to keep their children and know that they'll be cared for while the parents begin the process of rebuilding their lives.
Laura, this may be way too far out, but is anyone even beginning to talk about rebuilding and rebuilding in a way that withstands earthquakes or other disasters that have hit Haiti before, like hurricanes?
You know, we haven't started actively talking about what that would look like, but I think a couple of different options. People have talked about how can we enforce building codes? Would we consider moving and creating more homes outside of Port-au-Prince instead of rebuilding the infrastructure here if this is a quake prone city? So they think there are a lot of things that are being discussed, but one of the biggest challenges when you compare it to the tsunami and the rebuilding efforts there, when the tsunami came, it came and then it dragged everything back out with it. So you almost had a clean slate to start over again with rebuilding. Here, when the earthquake came, it came and then it left all of its devastation just where it was. So before we can even start rebuilding, we have to figure out how we're going to get rid of all the broken down homes and schools and workplaces.
Laura Blank with World Vision, thank you so much for joining us from Haiti today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Laura Blank, a World Vision aid worker in Port-au-Prince. World Vision is also the sponsor of this show. You heard Laura say that people in Haiti were just starting to talk about rebuilding Port-au-Prince. half of the buildings in the city were leveled. That's largely due to poor construction, something that's all too common in the developing world. The same thing happened in Indonesia 4 months ago when a massive earthquake struck there. Thousands of houses collapsed. But engineers know how to prevent that from happening. Chad Bouchard reports from Padang, Indonesia.
Along the side of a busy road, Elizabeth Hausler picks through the ruins of homes destroyed in the September quake. She picks up a handful of the material used to bind the brick walls together. It crumbles like a sandcastle.
Oh yeah, that's very weak. So I can break apart the mortar and I can crush it. I can break it apart with my hand and I can crush it with my fingers with very little finger pressure, which indicates that there was not a lot of cement in this mix.
Hausler is the founder and CEO of Build Change, a San Francisco-based organization promoting the use of earthquake-resistant building techniques in high-risk areas like West Sumatra. She's a civil engineer with a focus on earthquake damage. After studying the effects of such disasters in developing countries like India and Iran, Hausler discovered that thousands of people were dying in building collapses that could easily be prevented. She says small, critical changes in construction, like soaking bricks in water to make mortar bonds stronger, or connecting walls with steel reinforcement, can save lives.
You need the steel to kind of tie all the way around the wall, like a big rubber band, to hold the wall together, even if it cracks a little bit, it doesn't collapse. In Indonesia, it's not really common practice to tie that steel together at the corner, but it's really necessary. It doesn't really cost that much more.
The group doesn't actually build the houses. Rather, they advise and train other organizations that are helping with reconstruction. In the village of Garagahan, a resident uses an axe to hone the ends of a piece of timber so they'll fit together more securely. He's building a frame for a temporary shelter his family will use. Build Change hosted a community meeting to show methods like this to homeowners. It also trained members of Catholic Relief Services in quake-resistant construction techniques. But getting residents to adopt safer methods isn't always easy. Here in the village of Garagahan, the CRS regional coordinator and an Indonesian engineer have spotted a few problems.
Is that sphere compliant?
Is this compliant to our standard?
There's not enough cross bracing to make this temporary shelter stable during an earthquake.
Are the connections well done? The weather done the connections?
The connection.
The homeowners have cut a couple of corners despite the group's advice. So has Arlina Wati. Like many Indonesians, she goes by just one name. Her house was destroyed in September's quake. CRS gave her about $200 to begin building this temporary shelter, parts of which will eventually be incorporated into her permanent home. She says she's grateful for the help, but she's keeping a close eye on her budget.
Yeah, they gave us building advice when they handed out the money. But in fact, we already knew a lot of those things. They said, do it this way, do it that way, to make it stronger. When we get some more money, we'll put another brace in.
But not far away, the village of Rana seems to provide a quiet testament to the effectiveness of good construction techniques. Desna Wati, a survivor of West Sumatra's 2007 earthquake, crushes dried mung bean pods under her feet to release the beans inside, which she sells at a local market. 80% of the homes in Rana were leveled 2 years ago, but they've since been rebuilt under close supervision from Build Change.
The building techniques we are using are better now. The problem before was that the steel bars were not used all the way to the top. If it's that way, the walls can tumble right down. But if you put those bars in, they pull on each other and the house doesn't collapse.
Rana was shaken during the recent quake, but none of its houses suffered damage. Neighboring villages, where earthquake-resistant techniques were spurned, did not fare so well. Still, Desna Wati says when the recent quake struck, the whole town ran out into the rice fields in a panic. Stronger houses might not have erased their earthquake fears, but they know the next time a big one hits, they'll be more likely to survive. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chad Bouchard in Padang, Indonesia.
Now we go to Afghanistan, where this past week, five suicide bombers launched a coordinated attack on the capital of Kabul, A long gun battle followed between police and Taliban fighters. Reporter Will Everett was there when the explosions took place. He describes what happened after the assault in this reporter's notebook.
Call it providence or karma, or just plain good luck. With a full round of interviews scheduled in downtown Kabul, my translator and I were stuck at the guest house that morning because I couldn't find my room key. I felt pretty stupid. The night guard and the cook all joined in as we tore the room apart looking for that key. That's when we heard the first explosion. It sounded like a distant thunderclap, but it was a cloudless day and we knew it couldn't be thunder. Then four more explosions sounded in rapid succession. Cell phones started ringing and the bad news filtered in. Kabul was under siege. Soon the guest house manager arrived, wearing a dazed expression. Ali Riza was in a car downtown trying to get to work when the explosions took place.
The bus in front of us stopped and the driver jumped out, leaving everyone on board. Our car couldn't move, so we got out and ran. Just as we were coming toward the Ministry of Justice, another bomb exploded. This one was much worse. I saw someone I knew running down the sidewalk. He was covered with blood. Not his blood, but the blood of the suicide bomber. Everyone was panicking. We didn't know which way to turn. Where would the next bomb go off?
When I was here for the first time 5 years ago, a suicide bombing was almost unheard of. Now it's just a way of life, another burden the people of Kabul simply have to bear. And yet, a coordinated attack by five suicide bombers was a bit much, even for a society that had become jaded to this sort of thing. All morning, the streets were jammed as people scrambled to get home to their loved ones. Businesses closed for the day. The fear on the streets was palpable. Word was circulating that the Taliban were storming the city. People huddled around transistor radios and TVs. You could see it in their eyes. Surely, this can't be happening again. And then, just as quickly, the chaos was over. By late afternoon, the traffic was back to normal and people relaxed, some even laughing at their own fear. That night, the power went off across the city. It had nothing to do with the attacks. It was just another burden the people of Kabul have learned to live with. The guesthouse employees shrugged it off and went to each room lighting candles. As one told me, you can get used to just about anything if you have to live with it long enough.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. We'll be hearing more of his reports from Afghanistan in the coming weeks. Coming up, rebuilding lives with a soccer ball. Stay with the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Soccer means everything to me. Believe me, if you take soccer away from me, then you are taking all my life away.
That's a soccer player from the Congo, and what he says pretty much says it all. Soccer is huge in Africa. Wherever you go, from the cities to the smallest rural village, you can usually find a game of soccer underway. And right now, the continent is getting a good dose of its favorite pastime. The Africa Cup is taking place in Angola. And we're sure there are some guys in Boise, Idaho, who are following that tournament pretty closely. Sadie Babbitts reports on the Boise Wonders.
Rays of sunlight filter through towering elm trees as a group of men kick around a soccer ball. You can find this team here in this Boise park every Tuesday and Thursday evening. All of the players are refugees from Africa. They call themselves, naturally, the Africa team. But in the Southern Idaho Soccer League, they're officially known as the Boise Wonders.
My name is Ibrahim Kituta Asimba. I'm from Congo.
How long have you been playing soccer?
I've been playing soccer since my childhood.
Asimba is one of 16 soccer players that make up the Africa team. When he sees me, he leaves the practice and appoints himself the group's spokesman. It's a natural fit for him. Asimba wants to study communications. He tells me he'll play any position on the field, but loves kicking the ball the most.
Soccer means everything to me. Believe me, if you take soccer away from me, then you are taking all my life away. And it does me good. I mean, I feel good when I play soccer.
He says when he came to Boise more than a year ago, he thought his soccer playing days were over. Soccer isn't nearly as big in the U.S. as it is in Africa. Then Asimba heard about this group through other refugees. He says there's something special about playing for a team with so many different nationalities.
That's the beauty of this Africa, the team which we want to build in Boise. We want to make sure that all the African people come together and and unite, I mean, toward this team. So I hope in the future that it will bring all the people together.
Yo, captain!
Come here. Yeah, he's captain.
The team's captain, 26-year-old Fidel Nashambo, jogs over to the sidelines. Nashambo grew up in Congo, but he was separated from his family during the civil war there. On his own from the age of 12, he spent a decade as a refugee in 8 different African countries. 3 years ago, he resettled in Boise.
So in refugee camps, the most thing people do was playing soccer. Every day, the best of the day is the time of practice and soccer practice. So that commitment, that love of the game, and it brings a lot of happiness and healing into the process.
That healing comes simply from playing, sharing, and laughing with teammates. Midfielder Muhadin Aden from Somalia ducks out for a break. He goes by the name Bushka.
I remember last week I scored one goal over there. One of the best goals I've never imagined in my life.
In Africa, I think, Bushka, you were telling me you didn't play with shoes.
Over there, like, as you're from, like, Kenya, like, as a refugee over there, because shoes, a lot of money. We play without shoes and then no grass.
Asimba and Nashambo joined the conversation.
Yeah, you know, soccer in Africa, you know, so many people, so many families cannot afford to buy soccer booth and balls, so sometimes we make our artificial balls.
These are soccer balls made out of used plastic bags, carefully wrapped together and tied tightly with string. It's getting dark, so Nashambo calls the team together for a final chat. They talk about how practice went and find out they're getting a new player. The conversation shifts as Nashambo calls a teammate out for having a poor attitude.
I really want you to focus and to be part of the family. You have to smile. You have to talk when you're playing. Don't have the attitude on your face like you were doing today and playing lazy.
Nashambo wants the Africa team to be a positive experience for young players and for the community.
We need to show the people that the refugees are not just people who have been devastated by the wars. So we need to come together as a family.
That soccer family, Nashambo says, is helping these players move past their own devastating stories to fully embrace their new lives in Idaho, both on and off the field.
Today, and I think we had a great practice. So Thursday again, same time.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Boise, Idaho.
Since we reported this story, Fidel Nashambo says 3 players from the Africa team have received scholarships to play soccer at a university in Oregon. The whole world will be watching the 2010 Soccer World Cup in South Africa in June. It's the first time the tournament has been held in Africa. This is Somali rapper Kanon with the tournament's anthem, Waving Flag.
Learn from these streets, it can be bleak, accept no defeat, surrender, retreat. Struggling, fighting to eat, and we wondering when we'll be free. So we patiently wait for that fateful day. It's not far away, but for now we say, when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back.
And now, the Global Guru. That's a new segment we'll be bringing you every so often. Writer Rachel Louise Snyder will answer one simple question, just one, from somewhere in the world.
Today we're in Australia, learning how to wade through souvenir kitsch to find an authentic Aboriginal boomerang. I spoke with Carolyn Martin, curator at the Melbourne Museum.
The boomerang is actually a universal instrument or tool, weapon.
Wait, the boomerang is a weapon?
Yeah, it's a main weapon. It can be a main weapon.
Okay, so I thought it was like a frisbee for singles.
It might be used like a frisbee now.
But it has an illustrious history.
The killing boomerang, the hunting boomerang, which is killing, obviously. But as a musical instrument and for ceremony.
Mostly it was used for hunting. I saw lots of boomerangs in markets, often painted with surfing scenes or kangaroos. But I wanted to see real ones.
Traditionally, Aboriginal people would have put the markings that were significant to them on the boomerang. So you could actually tell who the person was and where they actually came from.
A week earlier in Sydney, I'd found a tiny shop of boomerangs run by a charming man in his 80s with stories from World War II. I bought one.
He had some tourist ones. He had some made in China, and he pointed those out and then pointed us to the authentic ones. And he said that it was made by a father and son.
This is very commercial. This is something that you would find anywhere. It's actually plywood.
Oh, darling.
Oh.
You've been so hard.
Not only that, but she says it was made in a factory. In the gallery, she shows me authentic boomerangs. They're sturdy, hard wood. Also,
boomerangs can range from as little as 10 centimeters to 2 meters, depending on the purpose. Now, this is a perfect example of the only sort of boomerang that you would see with color. And the colors are made from the ochre.
Before I leave, she has one final bit of advice.
If they don't come back, they're generally a stick.
A stick. Got it. The Global Guru is sponsored by World Vision Report and American University's College of Arts and Sciences. To submit ideas, email globalguru@american.edu. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
From Australia, we go westwards across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar, an exotic island known more for its lush tropical rainforests and wildlife than for its music. But it won't stay that way for long if Tarika Bay has its way. Our guide to global music, Ish Mafundikwa, is here to tell us more. Hi, Ish. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's always great to be here, Peggy.
The reviewers have loved this band. One reviewer said they produced the most gorgeous album he'd ever heard. So tell us, you know them, you've interviewed them. Tell us about Tarika. What is this band about? Where are they from? And what's unique about the music?
Tarika means group in Malagasy. And they started out as Tarika Sammy. And Sammy led the group. And there was his cousin Solomon and sisters Anitra and Noro. They released their debut album, Fana Food, in 1992. That's when I first met Anitra in Amsterdam when they were promoting that album. She told me then how prior to its release, nobody in Madagascar thought people outside the island would be excited about Malagasy music.
You said Malagasy, which we should say that refers to people from Madagascar.
Yes, they're from Madagascar, from the island, which is off the East African coast.
And is the music more, does it have an African flavor or is it more Indonesian?
It's a mixture of both because the people from all over the place on that island.
So it's very rich with the flavor of Madagascar, which many of us haven't heard before because that's not a real popular sound until now. Do they have their own instruments from that region?
Yeah, they do have their own instruments, the kabosi, which is a small guitar, and then the valiha, which is a bamboo zither, and the maravani, which is a box zither.
That's really beautiful music. I'm surprised that Malagasy music hasn't become more popular.
Well, it has become more popular after Tarika came onto the scene. I think prior to that, the focus was really on the African mainland, and I think Madagascar was kind of forgotten. It left out in the flurry of the so-called world music in the late 80s. After they broke up, they recorded this album called Bibiango, which was their debut album, is Plain Tarika. And the track we're going to hear from that one is called Safidi.
So Ish, the second album that they produced as the band called Tarika was called Sun Egal. In French it means equal sound, but in Malagasy, Sanegali means Senegalese. So it was actually a play on words. What's that about?
This was about history because Madagascar is a former French colony. And in 1947, the Malagasy revolted against French rule. And the French brought in Africans from the mainland who were trained in Senegal to crush the insurrection. But to the Malagasy, all these people were Senegalese. Anitra told me how when she was young, the Senegalese were like the bogeyman.
So she grew up really disliking, maybe hating the Senegalese because of this conflict with Senegal.
But she, being a cosmopolitan person, she lived in London and I'm sure she got to meet some Senegalese people. And she decided that there was need for reconciliation. And she actually got some Senegalese music to feature as guests on the album.
Well, let's hear a song from this album of reconciliation. Actually, there's a song called Senegalese. So if a musician's success is mostly measured by record sales and awards, how would you say Tarika has fared?
Well, you know, topping the world music charts means that their records were definitely selling. And in 2001, Time magazine listed Tarika as one of the 10 top bands in the world. Mm.
Now, you would think after all this popularity and leaving this small island, she might stay away. But Tarika had deep roots in Madagascar and went back and really got involved by writing music about the plight and the struggles of the Malagasy.
Absolutely. Her heart was back home.
And she went home and she built this art center. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, she described it to me. It's a place where people can come together and play. And she also says it's a place where people from other cultures can come and brainstorm with Malagasy people, play, and they have plays and they have a small auditorium there. She always said she wanted to do that.
Now, she's brought Madagascar music to the world. I'm wondering if she and her band paved the way for other musicians.
Oh, yeah, there's a few people now out there. I mean, when I first met her, she told me that you could count the number of international albums from Madagascar on half a hand. But at last count, I think there was over 90.
And yet now I understand, Ish, you've spoken to her recently, and she's moving away from Madagascar. And she talked to you a little bit about that.
Yes, she certainly did. As you might know, there was a lot of unrest, political unrest in Madagascar earlier this year. And it culminated in the democratically elected president fleeing the country.
Can you tell us a little of the themes she covers in her music that are tied to some of the struggles of Madagascar?
Well, she sings about the poverty in their country, the lack of democracy and women's rights, and she covers a whole lot of issues.
One of her songs that's very popular that I think she wrote almost 20 years ago was a song called Avelo, which she wrote in response to conflicts that were happening back then in Madagascar.
Avelo means ghost, and she's talking here about the lack of respect for the ancestors, and she also sings about the spirits of the ancestors coming out to punish bad politicians. And she's talking about how the ancestors, or the ghost, as she says, will come back and punish them.
You know, she seems to be so proud of her national identity and to care so much about the history and culture of her country. Do you think she'll ever go back to Madagascar to live?
I did ask her that question, and the answer was an unqualified yes. She says at the moment she just needs space to be an artist.
Can you tell us a little about Tarika's latest album?
Tap and Roots is their latest album, which was recorded in Madagascar. When she gave it to me, she apologized about the quality because she says there's still no decent recording facilities.
And do you have a favorite song, piece-ish, from Tap and Roots that we should go out on?
There's the reggae-flavored Higher, which I really like. And it's also more accessible to me because I understand the lyrics because it is in English.
Let's listen to that. And Inish, thanks so much again for bringing us world music.
Always a pleasure, Peggy.
You better be no good. You better be no one. You better have no speech because it's better to be at the bottom. You better be no good.
Ish Mufundukwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. And that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to visit our website, where you can download a podcast or read blogs from our reporters around the world. The program was produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.